And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today's July 31st, 212th day of the year. Only 153 days remain till this year is over with. And holidays and observances. National Mutt Day. Harry Potter's birthday. Hawaii Flag Day, International Lifeguard Appreciation Day, Martyrdom Day of Shahid Udham Singh, National Avocado Day, National Diana Day, National Jump for Jelly Beans Day, National Raspberry Cake Day, Shredded Wheat Day, Uncommon Instrument Awareness Day, and World Ranger Day, where we pay tribute to the unsung heroes who protect, preserve, and defend America's dwindling wilderness. All that having been said, you know, there's a lot of things going on in the world right now. The Wagner mercenary group is supposedly getting ready to roll into Poland, and that would, of course, initiate what will quickly become World War III. You know, we're shoveling money into Ukraine as fast as we can go. The question becomes, what's happening to that money? Because it's not all being spent buying weapons. We're making a lot of multimillionaires, as usual. Well, in 30 BC, the Battle of Alexandria, Mark Antony achieves a minor victory over Octavian's forces, but most of his army deserts, leading to his own suicide. 781 AD, the oldest recorded eruption on Mount Fuji. That's the traditional Japanese date, sixth day of the seventh month of the first year of the Tenno era. Well, on 1009, Pope Sergius IV becomes the 142nd Pope, succeeds Pope John the 18th. 1201, attempted usurpation by John Komnenos the Fat for the throne of Alexios III Angelos. 1423, 100 Years' War, Battle of Cravant. Franco-Scottish armies defeated by the Anglo-Burgundians at Cravant on the banks of the River Yonne. 1451, Jacques Coeur is arrested by the order of Charles VII of France. 1492, all remaining Jews are expelled from Spain when the Alhambra Decree takes effect. Now, for those not familiar with the Alhambra Decree, note is the Edict of Expulsion, issued March 31st, 1492, by the joint Catholic monarchs of Spain, that's Isabella I of Castile and Ferdinand II of Aragon, ordering the expulsion of practicing Jews from the crowns of Castile and Aragon, its territories and possessions, by July 31st of that year. Primary purpose was to eliminate the influence of practicing Jews on Spain's largely former Jewish converso, new Christian population. Basically, you had a choice, convert or die. 1498, on his third voyage to the Western Hemisphere, Christopher Columbus becomes the first European to discover the island of Trinidad. 1618, Maurice, Prince of Orange, disbands the Ward Gelder's militia in Utrecht, pivotal event in the counter-remonstrant tensions. 1655, Russo-Polish War. Russian army enters the capital of the Grand Duchy of Lithuania, Vilnius, which it holds for 6 years. On this date in 1658, Aurangzeb is proclaimed Mughal Emperor of India. 1703, Daniel Defoe is placed in a pillory for the crime of seditious libel after publishing a politically satirical pamphlet, but is pelted with flowers and not rocks or vegetables. 1715, 7 days after a Spanish treasure fleet of 12 ships left Havana, Cuba for Spain, 11 of them sink in a storm off the coast of Florida. A few centuries later, that treasure is salvaged from the wrecks. 1741, Charles Albert of Bavaria invades Upper Austria and Bohemia. 1763, Odawa Chief Pontiac's forces defeat British troops at the Battle of Bloody Run during Pontiac's War. 1777, the U.S. Second Continental Congress passes a resolution that the services of Gilbert du Montier, Marquis de Lafayette, be accepted in consideration of his zeal, his illustrious family and connections. He'll have the rank and commission of Major General of the United States. 1790, first U.S. patents issued to inventor Samuel Hopkins for potash process, which is necessary in the making of gunpowder. 1856, Christchurch, New Zealand is chartered as a city. 1865, the first narrow gauge mainline railway in the world opens in Grantchester, Queensland, Australia. 1874, Patrick Francis Healy becomes the first African American inaugurated as president of a predominantly white university. That was Georgetown University. 1904, Russo-Japanese War, Battle of Assimuching. Units of the Imperial Japanese Army defeat units of the Imperial Russian Army in a strategic confrontation. 1917, World War I, the Battle of Passchendaele begins near the Ypres, Western Flanders, Belgium. 1932, the NSDAP, that's the Nazi Party, wins more than 38% of the vote in German elections. 1938, Bulgaria signs a non-aggression pact with Greece and other states of Balkan Entente, that's Turkey, Romania, and Yugoslavia. Also in 1938, archaeologists discover engraved gold and silver plates from King Darius the Great in Persepolis. 1941, the Holocaust, under instructions from Adolf Hitler, Nazi official Hermann Göring orders SS General Reinhard Heydrich to submit to me as soon as possible the general plan of the administrative material and financial measures necessary for carrying out the desired final solution of the Jewish question. 1941 also saw the Battle of Smolensk concludes with Germany capturing about 300,000 Soviet Red Army prisoners. 1945, Pierre Laval, the fugitive former leader of Vichy France, surrenders to Allied soldiers in Austria. 1948, at Idlewild Field, New York, New York International Airport, later called John F. Kennedy International Airport, is dedicated. 1948, USS Nevada is sunk by an aerial torpedo after surviving hits from two atomic bombs as part of post-war test and being used for target practice by three other ships. It did not want to sink, folks. 1964, Ranger Program. Ranger 7 sends back the first close-up photographs of the moon with images 1,000 times clearer than anything ever seen from earthbound telescopes. 1966, the pleasure cruiser MV Darwin disappeared off the Cornwall coast with the loss of all 31 people on board. 1970, Black Tot Day, the last day of the officially sanctioned rum ration in the Royal Navy. 1971, Apollo program. Apollo 15 astronauts become the first to ride in a lunar rover. 1972, the Troubles. Operation Motorman, the British Army retakes the urban no-go areas of Northern Ireland. Biggest British military operation since the Suez Crisis of 1956, and the biggest in Ireland since the Irish War of Independence. Later that same day, 9 civilians are killed by car bombs in the village of Cloudy. 1973, a Delta Airlines jetliner, flight DL-723, crashes while landing in fog at Logan International Airport in Boston, Massachusetts. 89 people are killed. 1975, the Troubles. Three members of a popular cabaret band and two gunmen are killed during a botched paramilitary attack in Northern Ireland. 1987, a tornado occurs in Edmonton, Alberta, kills 27. 1988, 32 people are killed and 1,674 injured on a bridge at the Sultan Abdul Halim Ferry Terminal collapses in Butterworth, Penang, Malaysia. 1991, the U.S. and Soviet Union both signed the START 1 Strategic Armament Reduction Treaty. First to reduce, with a verification, both countries' stockpiles. 1992, the nation of Georgia joins the United Nations. 1992, the Thai Airways International Flight 311 crashes into a mountain north of Kathmandu in Nepal, kills all 113 people on board. 1992, China General Aviation Flight 7552 crashes during takeoff from Nanjing Daxiaochang Airport, killing 108. 1997, FedEx Express Flight 14 crashes at Newark International Airport, injures 5. 1999, Discovery Program. Lunar Prospector. NASA intentionally crashes the spacecraft into the moon, thus ending its mission to detect frozen water on the moon's surface. 2006, Fidel Castro hands over power to his brother Raul. 2007, Operation Banner, the presence of the British Army in Northern Ireland and the longest-running British Army operation ever, comes to an end. 2008, East Coast Jets Flight 81 crashes near Owatonna Degner Regional Airport in Owatonna, Minnesota, kills all 8 people on board. 2012, Michael Phelps breaks the record set in 1964 by Larissa Ladinina for the most medals won at the Olympics. I think that record has also been broken as well. That Phelps set. 2014, gas explosions in southern Taiwanese city of Kaohsiung kill at least 20 and injure more than 270. Well, you know, there have been a lot of stories that have been told about various things this country's been up to. A lot of it's laid at the doorstep of the CIA. And I had somebody ask me, would I talk about the CIA? You know, we were a relative latecomer to intelligence gathering, believing at first that such secret tactics didn't belong in a free society. But in time, the OSS and then the CIA came to excel at spying, eventually outpacing many countries around the world. Now, at the beginning of the World War II, we generally lagged behind the other nations in the collection and analysis of intelligence, especially when you compare us to Great Britain's Military Intelligence Section 6, or MI6 as it's called, which was founded as the Foreign Section of the Secret Service Bureau in 1909. Various military services and federal agencies collected and analyzed intelligence, but in an ad hoc, uncoordinated way. In part, this was due to the concerns about the potentially corrosive effects of an agency like the CIA on a free society like the U.S. In fact, one Secretary of State said, "Gentlemen, don't read other people's mail." But the experiences of World War II changed everybody's minds. The country entered the war following the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, and then considered a massive intelligence failure. President Roosevelt established the Office of Strategic Services, or the OSS, in June 13, 1942. And though it only lasted for 3 years, the OSS cast a long shadow that impacted the CIA's formation and early development. Now, this wouldn't suggest that we had ignored the value of intelligence before World War II. Far from it. Intelligence operations date to the United States founding, but they were somewhat haphazard and ad hoc and usually connected to a specific war rather than organized ongoing effort. During the Revolutionary War, George Washington made intelligence collection a top priority. In fact, even though the Continental Army was chronically short of funds throughout the war, he made sure to spend money to establish and support spy networks in British-occupied territory, most famous of which was the Culper Spy Ring, which was formed in 1778. In August of 1776, Washington established a reconnaissance and espionage detachment under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Nolan, known as Nolan's Rangers. This was the nation's first organized intelligence unit and the predecessor of U.S. Army Intelligence and Security Command. Though in my experience, military intelligence is kind of an oxymoron. Some of the stupidest people I've ever known gravitated toward intelligence gathering. Now, Washington's influence on American intelligence collection was so great that in 1997, the CIA named a meeting room after Washington in Its Liaison Conference Center at CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. And I might also point out that it was Nathan Hale of the Continental Army's 19th Regiment. He was one of the first American spies during the Revolutionary War. Captured by the British in September 1776 and hung for treason. And let's not forget Alan Pinkerton, and President Lincoln quite often assigned him to gather intelligence on the Confederacy. Now, American intelligence collection didn't stop with Washington. During the Mexican-American War, 1846 to 1848, President James K. Polk refused to turn over to Congress documents it requested because doing so might imperil the U.S.'s ability to collect intelligence. According to what Polk had to say at the time, in time of war or impending danger, the situation of the country may make it necessary to employ individuals for the purpose of obtaining information or rendering other important services who could never be prevailed on to act if they had the least apprehension. Your names or agency would be divulged. And 15 years later, during the American Civil War, both government of the U.S. and that of the Confederate states deployed spies against one another. Abraham Lincoln turned to the Pinkerton National Detective Agency, as I said, a firm that offered personal and corporate security, private detective, and later strike-breaking services. The company's president, Alan Pinkerton, guarded Lincoln as the president-elect traveled to Washington, D.C. for his inauguration and provided estimates of Southern strength to General McClellan during the early part of the war. It was one of Pinkerton's agents, Timothy Webster. He was the Civil War's first double agent, pretending to work for the Confederacy's network of couriers known as the Secret Line. At the same time, he was passing information to Pinkerton. In addition, other U.S. government officials and military leaders created their own spy networks, which included enslaved people. Among the most prominent of these was Harriet Tubman, who escaped enslavement in 1849 and became an operator on the Underground Railroad. And her forays into the South to liberate the other enslaved people gave her invaluable intelligence networks, which allowed her to perform important work for the federal government. She actually mapped the South Carolina coastline for the Union Navy. Meanwhile, the Confederacy employed several spies, most notably women like Rose O'Neill Greenhow, a prominent Washington, D.C. socialite, used her connections to gather intelligence on the federal government's actions and strategy. And during World War I, the administration of President Woodrow Wilson implemented several measures designed to gather and analyze intelligence. He came into office skeptical of intelligence gathering and spying, was personally offended by Germany's espionage activity. He had resisted entering the conflict when it began in 1914. But by early 1917, we were inching closer and closer to war, thanks in part to the discovery of a secret telegram sent by Germany's foreign minister to the Mexican government, promising to return to territory in the American Southwest in exchange for Mexican support of the Central Powers' cause. This was the famous Zimmerman telegram, being intercepted and decoded by British intelligence, not U.S. intelligence, and there was a lot of discussion about whether or not it was a valid instrument of the German government as opposed to a ploy by the British to get us riled up enough to get into the war. During his April 2, 1917 speech before Congress asking for a declaration of war against Germany, he noted one of the things that served to convince us that the Prussian autocracy was not and could never be our friend is that from the very outset of the present war, it's filled our unsuspecting communities and even our offices of government with spies and set criminal intrigues everywhere afoot against our national unity of counsel, our peace within and without, our industries and our commerce. Indeed, it's now evident that its spies were here even before the war began. And it's unhappily not a matter of conjecture, but a fact proved in our courts of justice that the intrigues, which have more than once
come perilously close to disturbing the peace and dislocating the industries of the country, have been carried out at the instigation, with the support, and even under the personal direction of official agents of the imperial government accredited to the government of the U.S. In other words, diplomats organizing spies in this country. By Wilson's own admission, he learned quickly that Germans' actions were common practice for European powers, telling a crowd in St. Louis, "I don't know, you didn't know it until we got into this war, but I didn't believe it when I was told that it was true. Germany's not the only country that maintained a secret service. Frankly, every country in Europe maintained it because they had to be ready for Germany's spring upon them. Only difference between the German secret service and other secret services was that the German secret service found out more than the others did, and therefore Germans sprang upon the other nations unaware and they weren't ready for it." But the realization that European spies were commonplace did little to change prevailing American attitudes, in part because U.S. participation in World War I was, in fact, somewhat brief. 1919, the U.S. Army and Department of State funded the creation and operation of the Cipher Bureau, also known as the Black Chamber, a cryptoanalysis organization disguised as a commercial code company, but it lasted only a decade. 1929, the newly appointed Secretary of State, Henry Stimson, withdrew State Department funding for the Black Chamber, famously declaring in his 1947 memoir, "Gentlemen do not read other people's mail." Well, unfortunately, that just showed that he was dumb as a brick. World War II seriously challenged Americans' aversion to intelligence collecting and spying. President Franklin Roosevelt appreciated the threat posed by the Axis powers, that's Germany, Italy, and Japan, and he decisively pursued policies designed to support the Allies before America became involved in the war. As a consequence, almost from the minute the war began on September 1, 1939, Roosevelt sought to improve the quantity and quality of information he had at his disposal. Of course, he could turn to the Department of State's reports from its regional bureaus, or Office of Naval Intelligence, or the Department of War's Military Intelligence Division, but there was no single source collecting, collating, analyzing, and making sense of what was a veritable mountain of information. Frustrated by the interdepartmental rivalries that maintained the status quo, he fell back on a familiar strategy. Turned to an outsider who could stovepipe information directly to him. July 11, 1941, Roosevelt issued executive order establishing the Office of the Coordinator of Information, led by William J. Wild Bill Donovan. It had been recommended to the President by Secretary of the Navy Frank Knox. In fact, Roosevelt had turned to Donovan in 1940, dispatching him to visit Great Britain and collect information about the British resolve. Then in early 1941, Donovan traveled to the Mediterranean and the Balkans and reported to Roosevelt on conditions there. And under the terms of Roosevelt's executive order, the COI could collect and assemble information and data bearing on national security from the various departments and agencies of the government and analyze and collate such material for the use of the president. Now, although the president went out of his way to assure the existing intelligence agencies that Donovan's work was not intended to supersede or duplicate or to involve any direction of or interference with their efforts, in the end, it didn't make any difference. Service bureaus and the Federal Bureau of Investigation remained wary of this new organization. Hoover wanted no part of it. He felt he was the end-all, be-all. Donovan's office grew quickly. By the time the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, December 7, 1941, that's less than 5 months after Roosevelt created the Coordinator of Information Office, the office employed nearly 600 people. And the attack on Pearl Harbor, which represented a colossal intelligence failure on everybody's part, increased the speed at which the Coordinator of Information grew. By June of 42, the office employed more than 2,000 men and women operating around the world. Moreover, the Coordinator of Information had moved beyond simply collecting and collating information, disseminating propaganda through the Foreign Broadcast Information Service. That was a multimedia outlet that produced radio broadcast and motion pictures as well as printed materials that were distributed around the world. You know, doing a... And we talked about the Office of Strategic Services, which was also run by Donovan. During its short existence, which was only 3 years, the OSS had an in-house research and development team tasked with developing weapons and other gadgets that could be useful by spies. Director of Research and Development was a chemist and inventor named Stanley Lovell. Among the many things he and his colleagues created were several types of guns for OSS officers, including the Stinger. It was a small tube about 3 inches in length, about the size of a cigarette, that contained a single .22 caliber bullet. Could be fired once and was non-reloadable, but its diminutive size meant it was frequently overlooked during searches. Had a lever. Lifting it cocked the gun, pushing it discharged the cartridge. And at close ranges, this cartridge was both accurate and lethal. And Lovell claimed to know of at least one captured OSS officer whose life was saved by using the Stinger. You know, once we entered World War II, the Coordinator of Information Office found itself unable to effectively achieve its mission. Roosevelt's executive order didn't give the Coordinator of Information power within the military, and Donovan's organization existed entirely outside the newly created Joint Chiefs of Staff. That was the body of senior military leaders who advised the president. Within weeks of the Joint Chiefs of Staff's creation in 1942, Donovan was pressing the president to include the Coordinator of Information as a supporting agency. But it took 4 more months before Roosevelt would act. June 13, 1942, he issued a military order transferring most of the Office of the Coordinator of Information activities to the Joint Chiefs of Staff jurisdiction and rechristening the Coordinator of Information as the Office of Strategic Services. According to Roosevelt's order, the OSS had two functions: collect and analyze such strategic information as may be required by the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and plan and operate such special services as may be directed by the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff. He just created the United States' first independent intelligence agency, blazing a path for that the CIA would later follow. Roosevelt's order establishing the OSS did little more than call the office into existence. It didn't establish a chain of command or even function as an organizational charter. December 23, 1942, the Joint Chiefs of Staff issued a directive outlining the OSS and its functions, stating that the organization was to plan, develop, coordinate, and execute military program for psychological warfare, and compile such political, psychological, sociological, and economic information as may be required for military operations. And its directive explicitly barred the OSS from operating in the Western Hemisphere, placed their commanders in control of the OSS's psychological operation, and finally called for the OSS to be reorganized to meet these objectives, a task accomplished by General Order No. 9, which was issued in January 1943. The Office of the Coordinator of Information had grown quickly. The OSS exploded. By the fall of 1943, 5,000 men and women worked for the organization, peaked a year later at 13,000 on the budget of $43 million. According to Director Donovan, were two assistant directors, as well as several deputy directors, and a host of offices designed to liaison with the various service branches. In general, though, the OSS was divided into two core functions, each supervised by a deputy director: Strategic Service Operations and Intelligence Services, that operated from a complex of BuArts buildings located on Observatory Hill in Washington, D.C., due west and slightly north of the Capitol. Donovan himself worked out of an office in Room 109, which is currently preserved as a memorial to the OSS. In fact, some of the buildings are still being used by the CIA. Training for the OSS was haphazard at best, given that the U.S. had few domestic precedents on which to draw. Included a broad range of topics such as hand-to-hand combat, codes, and demolitions, as well as more prosaic task like report writing. Missions might involve paramilitary activities, such as in June of 44 when OSS officers parachuted into southern France to assist that country's resistance to the Nazis. Or officers might be tasked with forging Filipino currency as a way to undermine Japanese control of those islands. However, officers could sometimes get carried away by flights of fancies when the OSS printed and distributed a book of forged Nazi postage stamps that depicted Adolf Hitler's head gradually becoming a skull. This was apparently done in the hope that this would sap German soldiers' morale. And that was a foreshadowing, so to speak, of some of the more controversial tactics the CIA would pull in the 50s and 60s against Indonesian President Sukarno and Cuban Prime Minister Fidel Castro. Donovan once described the ideal OSS recruit as a PhD who can win a bar fight. Though the OSS had a well-earned reputation of being a bastion of Ivy League privilege, reality is far more nuanced. On one hand, there were a lot of Ivy League types in the OSS. Wag sometimes said the initial stood for oh-so-social. On the other hand, two-thirds of its personnel were drawn from the military, and the rest from a broad range of careers. In fact, the group was so diverse and anarchic that some people referred to OSS personnel as the St. Elizabeth's, with reference to Washington, D.C.'s notorious asylum. Despite facing considerable discrimination in other aspects of the U.S. war effort, Jewish people and black people served in the OSS as well. Martin Gelb, an Orthodox Jew from Brooklyn, New York, parachuted behind German lines as a member of the OSS, and Ralph Bunche, the first black American to win a Nobel Peace Prize, served as a chief of the officer's African Affairs section. And maybe most surprising is the fact that one in three of the OSS employees were women. They served in various capacities, including operations. For example, singer and actor Melina Dietrich recorded a number of songs and interviews for the Muzak Project, a series of musical propaganda broadcasts by the OSS Morale Operations Branch. She'd win the Medal of Freedom in 1947 for her work entertaining Allied troops. Judy McWilliams, later known for her married name, Julia Child, the famed chef and television personality, helped develop a formula for shark repellent, which was needed to prevent sharks from setting off underwater explosives or being used to destroy German U-boats. She has been posted to both Sri Lanka and China. Her work there as head of the registry of the OSS Secretariat garnered her an emblem of meritorious civilian service. At one point, even Vice President Henry Wallace's daughter, Jean, worked for the OSS. However, by far the most important female OSS officer was Virginia Hall, an American who volunteered to drive an ambulance in France in 1940. Following France's fall, she made her way to Spain, where she was recruited into Great Britain's Special Operations Executive. During 1941 and 42, she operated in Vichy, France, recruiting officers and collecting intelligence and helping downed British pilots escape enemy territory. Germans referred to her as the limping lady due to the fact that her left leg been amputated as a result of a hunting accident in the 1930s. She had a prosthetic replacement, which she had named Cuthbert. She escaped France in 42 and Special Operations Executive, fearing she'd been compromised, cut her loose. At that point, she joined the OSS and went back to France under a new identity. In this role, she collected valuable intelligence in preparation for the D-Day invasion. And after the war, she joined the CIA, working for it until she retired in 1966. Well, there have been several, I guess we could refer to them as silver screen spies. There was the Good Shepherd, a fictionalized telling of the CIA's beginnings. It's a heavily fictionalized story of the CIA's early years and the agency's distinctive culture at the time. The Good Shepherd, which came out in 2006, starred Matt Damon and Robert De Niro and Angelina Jolie. Directed by De Niro and released by Universal Pictures, the film tells the story of CIA officer Edward Wilson, a fictional officer based on the exploits of real-life CIA officers James J. Angleton, Richard Bissell, Jr., and Frank Wisner. Tapped by an OSS recruiter named General Bill Sullivan, based on William Donovan and played by Robert De Niro while attending Yale in the early 40s. Wilson, played by Damon, who's shown in a scene with Angelina Jolie's character, goes on to help found the CIA and take part in several well-known events in the agency's history, including an incident strongly reminiscent of the Project MKUltra experiments with LSD in the 50s that led to the death of Army chemist Frank Olson after officers surreptitiously dosed him. Moving ahead to the 60s, Wilson's son is also tapped by a CIA recruiter while a student at Yale and joins the agency. However, he ends up leaking details of an upcoming clandestine attack on Cuba to his lover, who it turns out is a Soviet spy. Wilson arranges to have the woman murdered, and the invasion of Cuba goes horribly awry, leading to a shakeup in the CIA and a promotion for Wilson. The CIA's Center for the Study of Intelligence convened a roundtable to discuss the film, which was a highly unusual response. Ultimately, the agency's in-house historians asserted that the film captured much of the details of agency life in the 50s and 60s, but misrepresented the OSS and the CIA's history by perpetuating several myths, including that the mysterious Yale fraternity skull and bones is where the agency recruited officers. In fact, one historian on the panel went so far as to dismiss the film as a propagandaminary. It may or may not have been a close, truthful telling. In April 1945, Donovan lost his patron when President Roosevelt died of a cerebral hemorrhage in Warm Springs, Georgia. Vice President Harry Truman, who'd largely been ignored by FDR in the few months he'd been vice president, took over the presidency. And Truman did not like Donovan. Then in August, Japan surrendered. Formal ceremony took place the following month, ending World War II, and removing the OSS's reason for existence. Within 3 weeks of Japan's official surrender to the United States aboard the USS Missouri, President Truman issued an executive order that he sent to Donovan. In it, the president gave Donovan 10 days to completely wind down the OSS's operations, some of which would be transferred to the State Department as the beginning of the development of a coordinated system of foreign intelligence within the permanent framework of the government. According to Truman in his memoir, "I considered it very important to this country to have a sound, well-organized intelligence system, but it was imperative we refrain from rushing into something that would produce harmful and unnecessary rivalries among the various agencies. One thing was for sure, this country did not want a Gestapo under any guise or for any reason." Well, whatever his intentions might have been, time went on his side. Conflict between the U.S. and Soviet Union was intensifying. Within 2 years, the president would create an intelligence agency that looked a lot like the one he just disbanded. But keep in mind that Truman was, in fact, a haberdasher who made good. Well, even though Truman didn't like Donovan, he's widely considered to be the CIA's founding father. He was the director from 1942 to 1945. William J. Wild Bill Donovan, who died in 1959, is best known as both the coordinator of intelligence during President Roosevelt's administration and the director of the Office of Strategic Services. And he's widely considered to be the CIA's founding father. Born in January 1883 in Buffalo, New York, to Timothy and Anna Letitia Donovan, the oldest of the family surviving five children. After attending St. Joseph's Collegiate Institute, a Catholic preparatory school, he went on to Niagara University. And though he majored in pre-law studies, he briefly considered becoming a priest. Eventually, he graduated from Columbia University and attended its law school, where he was a classmate of FDR. After graduating from Columbia's law school, he went back to Buffalo to practice law. same time, he joined the New York National Guard, where his unit was mobilized in 1916. He went to the U.S.-Mexico border to participate in the federal government's punitive expedition against Mexican revolutionary Pancho Villa, as did the unit I was assigned to in Panama. In fact, there is, and I don't know what happened to it. When they disbanded our Panama Canal command, this photographic record vanished into thin air. And later he joined the famed 69th New York Infantry Regiment, later renamed the 165th Infantry of the 42nd Division, saw service in World War I, won several decorations, suffered a shrapnel wound, and was hit in the knee by a bullet. After the war, he went back to Buffalo to practice law, but traveled the world gathering intelligence on events like the Russian Revolution for a variety of individuals, including the financier J.P. Morgan. During the early 20s, he served a two-year stint as the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of New York, and beginning in 1924 as Assistant U.S. Attorney General, position he held in 1929 when he resigned and went back to New York to resume the private practice of law. During his tenure as Assistant Attorney General, he hired many women, a practice that was unusual for the time, and when he continued as the head of the Office of Strategic Services. He developed a somewhat strained relationship with J. Edgar Hoover, a man serving as director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. He unsuccessfully ran for governor of New York in 1932 and spent much of that decade traveling, which put him into contact with such figures as Benito Mussolini. Though from two different political parties, the Democratic President Franklin Roosevelt and the Republican Donovan shared one key belief, that a second European war was inevitable, and the United States had to begin preparing for it. The 1940 release of the film The Fighting 69th, a Hollywood film that chronicles Donovan's unit exploits during World War I, raised Donovan's profile considerably. On the recommendation from Secretary of the Navy Frank Knox, Roosevelt's behalf, Donovan traveled to Great Britain and met with that country's leaders, including Prime Minister Winston Churchill and King George VI, and then reported his findings directly to the President. So he was certainly a natural choice to become the head of the Office of Coordinator of Information when the President created that office in the summer of 41. A year later, when Roosevelt created the Office of Strategic Services, Donovan was picked to head that agency as well. Well, as the war was winding down, the U.S. was faced with the task of trying war criminals, especially the senior Nazi leadership. Early as 1943, Donovan had pushed Roosevelt to make plans for this. Truman later appointed Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson as chief U.S. counsel in the trials held in Nuremberg, Germany. Jackson took Donovan along as a member of his staff. Following Truman's decision to disband the OSS, Donovan returned to private law practice, though that would be temporary. In 1947, Donovan strongly lobbied members of Congress to vote for the National Security Act of 47, which created the CIA. Congress did pass that act, but Truman, who did not like Donovan at all, refused to appoint the retired spy to head the new agency. Instead, he named Rear Admiral Roscoe Hillenkoetter. During the 1952 presidential election, Donovan stumped for Republican nominee General Dwight D. Eisenhower, who would win the election. But despite Donovan's expectation, Eisenhower would reward him by nominating him to head the CIA, the new president instead installed Alan Dulles, brother of Secretary of State John Foster Dulles. As a consolation prize, Eisenhower offered Donovan the post of ambassador to France, but he turned it down. President then offered Donovan the post of ambassador to Thailand, which the former spy accepted. However, Donovan held that post for just under a year. Stepped down in August of 1954 due to the onset of dementia. He returned to the U.S., and over the next few years, his symptoms worsened. He died February 8, 1959, at Walter Reed Army Medical Center, and the CIA's leadership sent out a cable mourning the loss of the man who was more responsible than any other for the existence of the Central Intelligence Agency. You know, as tensions ramped up between the U.S. and USSR in the wake of World War II, spying on both sides became commonplace. No, the Allies won World War II. The discord that surfaced between the U.S. and Soviet Union, even before the guns fell silent, would dominate the next half century of world history. Tension between the world's only superpowers led President Truman to propose a massive restructuring of American military and intelligence services. And despite Truman's fears of an American Gestapo, one result was the creation of the Central Intelligence Agency, a division led by a director of Central Intelligence. Since its inception, the office has been filled by several notable people, including George H.W. Bush, who later became president. You know, there's a lot of folks who believe that the creation of the CIA and the NSA was a direct result of the Roswell crash. And the more you dig, the more support you find for it, and the more support you find that says it's not true. So, Truman's successor, Dwight D. Eisenhower, used the CIA to accomplish, through clandestine means, that what the U.S. couldn't achieve through diplomacy. Agency played a role in the overthrow of several democratic governments, including those of Iran and Guatemala, and attempted to hatch plans to assassinate world leaders like Fidel Castro. In addition, CIA officers sometimes overstepped their mandate and violated American civil rights, spying on civil rights leaders and politicians, even performing controversial mind control experiments. And though angry at the agency in the wake of the failed Bay of Pigs invasion, Kennedy never made good on his threat to splinter the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds. In fact, his administration became an enthusiastic about covert operations, including assassinations, as Eisenhower's administration had been, leading the agency to undertake some of its most dubious missions. Though the U.S. and Soviet Union had been allies during World War II, the partnership quickly fell apart. Historians still debate whether the Cold War, as a half-century conflict between the U.S. and Soviet Union came to be called, was inevitable when it began and which side was responsible, but there's no question about 1946. Relations between the two superpowers were openly confrontational. February 9th, Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin blamed World War II on the inherent conflicts created by capitalism, suggesting he expected a confrontation between the Soviet Union and the United States. 2 weeks later, George Kennan, in serving as deputy chief of mission in Moscow, sent the State Department his infamous long telegram, later adapted into an article titled The Sources of Soviet Conduct, in which he also predicted conflict between the Soviet Union and the U.S. was inevitable. Following months, former British Prime Minister Winston Churchill delivered a speech at Westminster College in which he described the area under Soviet control as being behind an iron curtain, though he asserted the conflict between the two superpowers was not inevitable. But he nonetheless cautioned the U.S., "I'm convinced that there's nothing the Soviets admire as much as strength, and there's nothing for which they have less respect than for weakness, especially military weakness." Along with these signals, there were the triggering events surrounding Soviet Igor Gruzinko, a cipher clerk who worked at the Soviet embassy to Canada in Ottawa. He defected from the Soviet Union September 5, 1945, a mere 3 days after the end of World War II, carrying 109 documents that detail the Soviet Union's ongoing well-coordinated espionage activities, including its attempts to usurp nuclear secrets. Historians have credited Grishenko's defection and the revelation of these papers, which came to be known as the Grishenko Affair, as a key cause of the Cold War. Well, it's interesting to note that Stalin and Truman appeared very friendly at the Potsdam Conference, but it was there that Truman told Stalin the U.S. successfully tested its first atomic bomb. And it was after that that Igor Grushenko, a former Russian cipher clerk, defected to the U.S. Yeah, it wasn't surprising then that Truman had second thoughts about his decision to disband America's intelligence infrastructure. In January 1946, Truman created the Central Intelligence Group, organization designed to analyze and present intelligence from existing sources to the president, but they weren't charged with collecting it. The Central Intelligence Group was led by an individual known as Director of Central Intelligence. And it's 18 months after it was established, three men, Rear Admiral Sidney Sowers, Lieutenant General Hoyt Vandenberg, and Rear Admiral Roscoe Hillenkoetter, held that position. But the Central Intelligence Group was eclipsed in December 47 when Truman signed the National Security Act into law. It reorganized the U.S. military, established the U.S. Air Force as its own service branch, transformed the War Department into the Defense Department, and established the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, Truman reappointed Hillenkoetter as Director of Central Intelligence under the terms of the National Security Act, and he held that position until October 1950. Well, the Director of Central Intelligence reported to the National Security Council, a body created by the National Security Act and composed of the President, the Secretaries of the Service Branches, as well as the Secretaries of Defense and State, and the Chairman of the National Security Resources Board. Now, of course, the President could add other people as he saw fit. Beneath the DCI, as he was called, was Deputy Director of National Intelligence, and then the Executive Director, to whom the agency's four offices, Collection and Dissemination, Reports and Estimates, Special Operations and Operations, reported. The Central Intelligence Agency Act of 1949, which was a separate law, further clarified the CIA's organization responsibilities and exempted the agency from most oversight regarding its budget or its use of funds. In other words, the CIA would have broad discretion regarding its operations, and Congress had little oversight over its activities. That is, until the Church Committee rode roughshod over the agency after the Kennedy assassination. Finally, in 1948, the National Security Council issued Directive 10/2, which bemoaned the Soviets' ongoing espionage activities and created the Office of Policy Coordination with the purpose of carrying out covert activities. First head of the OPC, as it was called, was Frank Weiser, an OSS veteran, though not formally linked to the CIA initially. The OPC remained in close contact with the agency. Well, on that note, we come to the end of today's show. We'll talk more about the CIA in tomorrow's show. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.